Accession number 15590. Phil Plowright, reel 12.
Mr. Plowright, reel 12. We're talking about you've been wounded towards the end of the summer, well, very late summer, September more likely, probably. You're not sure where. When you were in hospital, did it take long for the wound to heal?
No. I was back in the line again in about 3 weeks. And I rejoined. I joined B Company.
And, so you changed company?
Yes. And we had. When I was sent back, I joined B Company. And. Significant things that happened there that.
Hang on a minute. Just. We were talking about your morale. I mean, you said you did get more nervy. How did that show itself? You'd been wounded as well, though. I mean, how did you feel?
Difficult to explain, really, I suppose. I was very cautious. I was certainly well aware of things like minefields. And when we went into attacks, I took precautions, used all the precautions that had come out of my experiences. Like keeping off roads. If there was a track, keep off a track, move away from it. We were attacking a farmhouse near Cesano. Near Cesano. I remember this quite well because I've got a photograph of prisoners that we took there. One of these fellas gave me a photograph, and I still have it. And it's it was near Cesano. We were moving along on the way towards Cesano and mopping up isolated positions. And on this occasion, it was a night thing. We were moving off this track. On a bank on the top of the track, we could see the track below. We were moving along it quietly, and we heard footsteps approaching down this track, down this iron-coated track, if you like, a hard surface. I could hear the clank of boots along there, and we all got down at the back of a low thorn hedge looking down onto the track. And we saw a German carrying a load of blankets. And he must have heard us, and he shouted something, and one of our blokes shouted back. The thing that I remember as best I could was, "Is that so-and-so?" And this lad shouted, "No, it's the foresters." This is the way it's been interpreted, whether it's actually word for word, ad verbatim, I don't know. But anyway, this bloke shouted something, and one of our guys shouted, "It's the foresters." And this German threw the blankets off his back. It was all attached to a carry-all thing, a shoulder. And he threw it off and ran back down this track. And we fired and all that sort of thing. And didn't get him. And we moved on. And we moved on to this farmhouse, and we consolidated in this farmhouse. That's as far as we could go that night. And in the morning, from this farmhouse thing, there was a broken down old garden and broken down wall at the bottom. And we looked over there, and we could see Germans coming in from night positions. And they were coming back to this farmhouse, and we got the lot of them. We got the whole bag of them. There was about 20 of them.
You made them prisoners?
Yes.
Did they resist at all?
No. No, they didn't. They knew the game was up. And they were a cosmopolitan lot because we lined them up in a cow shed, and I got a photo. There was quite a young fellow there. One of them said that he spoke in broken English, that he was only young, and he gave me a photograph, and I still have this photograph of this boy, quite a young. He was far younger than me, which brings out what I was saying earlier about the quality of the troops. They weren't quite so good. There were youngsters mixed up with them, and even older men.
Were you getting jumpy at all? You said you were very cautious.
Mm.
But were you getting sort of edgy and jumpy or bad-tempered or any other?
I can't really remember, not with any great truth. I was certainly... I thought, well, I've gone so long now, I don't want to chuck it away if I can help it.
Would you sort of dread it before you...
Yes.
When we were going
into action, it was a terrible thing. I remember on one occasion we were going into the attack. I'd been to an O group. I think that was at a time before I had a platoon commander in between Glover and Greenwood. I'd been to an O group and we'd got the radio wavelength. They used to put out the radio call and you had to tune in and report your signal strength. It was Sunfish to whichever platoon it was. And you'd lie there and wait. And I remember lying down at the side. Now, this was much later, it must have been, because it was cold. The weather was cold and it must have been much later. Anyway, I'll continue now. I hadn't got a platoon commander anyway. I was commanding the platoon. And so Mr. Greenwood had been killed. He'd died or he'd been wounded. I'll recount to him afterwards. Because I was lying down at the side of some oxen to keep warm. And it was an awful feeling. Absolutely awful. I was really at my low point then. And I was sick. And...
Literally sick?
Yes. Felt awful. Absolutely awful. So that's just an example of how you felt. You felt dead. And then after that you did it by numbers. But the weather was... I remember the weather was so cold and wet that I got down at the side of these oxen to keep warm. And they were lying down in this straw in this farm place.
Do you remember any of the actions you did with Greenwood before he was...
Yes. We attacked a villa. We were clear of the Gothic line as such, and we were on the plains then, moving up. The villa, I remember it was quite a modern villa compared with some of the buildings that we'd been attacking in the Gothic line, farmhouses and reinforced German positions. And it was a two-platoon attack. There was one platoon in reserve, and we were to do a left flank onto this villa, the two platoons, to cover a good area. There was a squadron of Sherman tanks in support of us on this occasion. And we wheeled onto these, towards this villa, and we were fired on very heavily from the villa area. And there were some German positions already dug, and we just piled into those because we were under a very heavy small arms fire from the villa. And we had one or two wounded. There was several wounded, and Greenwood was with me, and he said, "What do you think we ought to do?" I said, "Well, we ought to try and make contact with the Company HQ and the reserve. The radio was out of action. We couldn't do it by radio. And the wounded blokes, it was getting warmish, and the wounded bloke was crying out with pain. And Greenwood said, "I can't stand any more of this." He says, "I'll have to try and find the Company HQ. It's over the back of this hill, apparently." And without... before I got time to warn him about moving, because it was obvious that we were under observation, he put his knee up onto the parapet of this old German trench to hoik himself up, and was shot straight through the groin. And he dropped back into the slit trench again. And we... he was talking quite normally. He knew he'd been hit, obviously. And I put a field dressing on him, and we lay there for a bit, knowing that we were pinned down, couldn't move. But it was obvious that Greenwood was suffering as well. So I decided that I would have a go. And I saw this great thorn hedge running quite near to our position, where our slit trench was, where Greenwood and I were, and it went up this hill, and I knew that over the hill would be, first, it would be safe, and secondly, that no doubt I would find the company commander and the squadron of tanks there, because they were waiting for, they were actually under his supervision. So I jumped out of this trench and ran like hell towards this thorn hedge and dived into it. And I squirmed and scrimmed all the way up, trying to keep the hedge as an obstacle to where the enemy were, between the enemy and myself, if you like. And I got to the top of this hill, and down the other side, sure enough, the company commander was there, and the squadron of tanks. And I told him what was happening, and he didn't know, reported it, and he said, "Would I guide talk the squadron commander," well, he told me to, not would I, "talk him down onto these positions," which is what I did. I walked to the back of this tank and talked into a telephone. And the squadron commander was firing them, and he saw got the sight of the villa, he just started to put all sorts down, phosphorus, smoke, and everything. And I dropped off into the slit trench where Greenwood was, and the tanks went on and they wiped up this area altogether. There were civilians in there as well. I remember when we were clearing up, there were quite a lot of German dead and wounded, very heavy casualties for the Germans there. And there was one civilian brought out, and he was holding his throat with a handkerchief, and our medical officer was now here looking round, and we took this Italian fella to him, and when he took away the handkerchief from his throat and his hand, it burst into flame. It was burning, actually burning, a piece of phosphorus there. So as soon as he removed it and the air got to it, it just flared up again. Anyway, they piled him onto the stretcher jeep and took him away. And he didn't live. But Greenwood, they took Greenwood away. And I carried on commanding the platoon.
Did he live, Greenwood?
No. I was going to say, I went to see him in hospital. Found out where he was, and... He knew he was dying. He said, I shan't be. I was kidding him on. I said, you'll make haste back. We're missing you, you know. He knew he was dying. And he died soon afterwards.
Do you remember? Do you remember any of the actions where you were with Greenwood? Obviously before.
Yeah, several, but I don't know where they were. I liked him, and I respected him.
Could you give us some illustrations of the sort of actions? You know, I know it's all out of order. It doesn't really matter too much because we're not knowing names of places. It's difficult to keep in order.
They were very numerous. Not specific.
What made him such a... Well, let's look at it. What made him so good?
Well, he was such a nice bloke. I don't know that he was a great soldier. I wouldn't say he's good as a soldier. I liked him as a man. I did like him, and I could talk to him. And he listened to me. He didn't come the old army bull and, oh, you're only a sergeant, that sort of thing.
Like when he asked you in the trench, yes?
Yes. We
were you on first name terms?
No.
So the ranks were...
You just called him sir, and he called me sergeant. Yeah, there was no Philip and whatever, I can't even remember what his name was. No, there was none of that. This is something that surprises me when I see films on the TV of the modern army, how the attitude be familiar in any way.
Well, although you weren't familiar, you were friendly.
Yes. Yes, we had a good, very good relationship. And I think we trusted each other.
Now, I know this whole here is a maze of actions. Do you remember any other incidents or stories you could tell us?
Talking about Moss, he was a man that, one of the steady, plodding, always reliable men. And he was a big, strong lad, and he carried a Bren gun. We attacked a position, and we took it. There were several German dead. It was on a sort of a mound, as I remember. There were several German dead, and there was nearby, about 200 or 300 yards, there was a farmhouse or a building, a big building. And having taken the position, we moved off and went to the farmhouse. We left Moss and another couple of guys on the mound with a Bren gun as a precaution and give us cover while we moved off. And while we went up to this house, the Germans counterattacked, and Moss stayed there and held it himself. It was never recognised. He didn't get a decoration for it. He never asked for one. It was just something that happened that he was able to cope with. There was no officer there, so there was no recommendation for any decoration. We weren't. It had to be an officer that recommended it and verified it. Yes, it was just an isolated incident and a case where one man had done well, done his duty well, as opposed to some of the others who came on to, when we got onto a position and we consolidated and checked upon casualties, they appeared then.
In the First World War, they called shell hole droppers, people who just disappeared during the next...
It could be, yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of that, wasn't
there? Oh, there was some of it. I wouldn't say there was a lot of it, but there was some of it. As I was telling you about when talking about this villa that I'd been talking about with Greenwood. I wanted smoke. I called for smoke. Or Greenwood...
Mortar smoke,
yes. 2-inch mortar, which would obscure us while I got Greenwood out, or while I got out. And we hadn't got any.
Why not?
There was men detailed to carry so many, and the 2-inch mortar man, and he carried, instead of rifle ammo, he carried smoke, about 4 bombs, I think, in his Ben gun pouches. And we hadn't got any. He'd got it filled up with fags and other things. And chocolate.
Is that common, that sort of, I mean, that's irresponsible. That.
Yes, it was. After ammunition had been issued before an attack, there was no other way of knowing whether you'd got it or not. It was up to the individual then.
And several of the men were irresponsible then?
Yes. Yes, they were.
They were risking their own lives as well, though, weren't they?
You couldn't tell them that. I've seen people doing all sorts of funny things for a cigarette. Swapping valuable things. Watches. I'll give you a watch for a cigarette. And I've got a camera. Give me a cigarette.
Did you have any men who actually broke and who ran away? Did you deserted? Just, you know, shell shock?
Yes. Yes, I did. But you didn't know until the fact that they weren't there when you wanted them. When we attacked the position, the first thing we did when we got there was consolidate and check up on your casualties and all the rest of it. And people didn't appear. And the next thing you knew about them, they were in hospital. And this shell shock, as you'd call it, I don't know what the proper name for it is, but they were knocked about pretty badly, nervously, you know, in the nerves.
How would that show itself?
Cigarettes, smoking cigarettes and hands shaking and all that.
Did you have sympathy for people who'd been knocked about?
No, not at that time, no.
What did you think of them?
I thought they were not doing their duty. But people react in so many different ways, don't they? And I've since learned a lot about stress and how it's affected my family and my wife and in different ways. And how it's affected a lot of my friends, certainly some of my army friends, all army comrades.
But then you had no sympathy?
Not really, no. I don't think I actually did anything else other than have no sympathy. I had no feelings towards them, possibly.
Did anyone actually desert, or...?
I can't recall anybody openly deserting, apart from old fellows.
You told me that.
Yes. But he didn't desert in that way. He made it clear that he was going, that he'd done his duty as he considered it, and he'd had enough of it. He wasn't going to put up with any more of it.
Order, didn't he?
Right.
What about self-inflicted wounds? Were there any of them?
I knew to one, an officer. I think I told you about that. Did I mention that previously?
I don't think so.
That was early on in the... It was crossing the Volturno at about that time. I had a bloke called Morrison. Morris. Lieutenant Morris, Geoffrey Morris, and he was on parade before we went abroad. He was always on parade and carried his stick and had his moustache and all the other things, and plenty of bull, always putting people on charges, and he turned out to be anything but what we thought he was going to be.
What happened then as you crossed the... If we just go back to it, I haven't got a note of it.
A shot rang out, and Morris cried out he'd been hit. But nobody else was hit. He was taken away and we never saw him again.
So it wasn't, you weren't sure he'd shot himself?
No.
But it was a widely held suspicion?
Yes, everybody thought that he had.
But that was the only one you knew of?
Another bloke we had, not in my platoon, but in the company, was a man, Poxon. Pongo, we used to call him. Pongo Poxon. And it was at a time when we were in the Middle East. And we'd come out the line, and he joined us. And he was a regimental sort of bloke. He'd not long been from England, and they made him transport officer. And he had a habit of stopping wagons, and where are you going? Where's your work order? And who told you to do that? And inspecting the men and the vehicles, and tapping it with his stick, and that's dirty, and that one's doing. And he stepped out in front of a wagon, holding his stick up, doing his regimental stuff, and the wagon kept on going and knocked him down. He was killed. Yeah.
So that wasn't so much a self-inflicted wound.
No, not really, no. But, in
he
fact,
was
I...
deliberate, they're not knocking him down.
Well, he certainly didn't expect him to dodge, but he didn't offer to stop. It was a bloke called Fred Cook, who was well known to us all. He only died about 3 years ago, Fred did. It was Fred that knocked him down.
And do you think he did it deliberately?
Well, he said that he didn't have time to stop. Pongo was hated.
Did he try and stop? Or he didn't?
Well, we never know.
Brakes and things?
We never know. We don't know. It's one of those... one of those things,
did
isn't
people
it?
People talk about blighty wounds and getting away from it all, you know, getting back to England.
Getting a blighty?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes, they wanted to get wounded and sent back home. There's a fellow that we know, I told you, Wild Gust. He, a lieutenant when he came out to Africa and he was injured the first night. He got a blighty, and he never went back in action again. But I've heard people say they wish they could get a blighty.
Did you feel like that?
No, I didn't. It frightened me to death.
You'd rather get through and not be wounded?
I would, yes. Yes, I would.
But any more operations?
When, during a night attack, it was a company attack... It was more than a company attack. It was probably two company attacks. A two company attack. A company commanded by a man called Williamson, Captain Williamson, and B company under the command of Major Tulloch, second in command, Captain Lord. It was Major Williamson, yes, it would be, not Captain. And we got on a minefield at night time. And Herbert Littlewood, who was in B Company with me, who was one of my great heroes, I mentioned him previously, he won the MM at another operation, ought to have won the VC. But Herbert and I were commanding the platoons. He was commanding his platoon and I was commanding mine. And we got on a minefield and we had to dig ourselves off. Now Williamson, Major Williamson, he was with A Company, as I said, and A Company hit the minefield first. And everybody froze. And panic, there was panicking, and one fella that was... There were shoe mines, in fact.
How did you know you were on it? Did someone see them?
Yeah, no, just this explosion. That made us start thinking about mines then, straight away. And
you said they were shoe mines?
Shoe mines. They were wooden mines, the shoe mine. And
were there any signs of them?
No. No, they're just buried just under the surface. Terrible thing. They took your foot off. And this what happened to this fellow got had his foot blown off. And the stretcher bearers dashed to him across this minefield to get him off. And later on they did, not at that moment, this fellow was crying in pain, and the stretcher bearers went to him, and Major Williamson shouted, "Shut that man up!" Just like that. And the next minute he got on one. Major Williamson got on one. The stretcher bearers got them off, more by luck than judgment, but we didn't know what was happening. We were stuck, we were in B Company, and that was A Company to our right. So the only thing we could do was to do the drill.